This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740. Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather round the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. Well, we have a busy show for you this evening. Don Jeffries, the author of Hidden History and his latest Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, will be here towards the bottom of the hour and then into hour two as well. And then, towards the tail end of the program, I'm dipping into the Wayback Machine and dusting off an old interview with the late rock and roll historian R. Gary Patterson to talk about John Lennon and the number 9. Of course, today marks the 39th anniversary of Lennon's murder outside the Dakota Building on New York City's Upper West Side, and I'll get Don Jeffries to weigh in on that as well. Coming up first, this is the second Sunday of the month, and that means a visit from the discoverer of reverse speech and the co-host of Reverse Speech Radio, David John Oates, and he's here with some audio clips forwards and in reverse of Mark David Chapman and John Lennon. Hey, David, welcome back to The Conspiracy Show. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing very well, thank you. After my long trek back home to Australia, but I seem to be settled in. So good to be back.
Wonderful, wonderful. All right, today is the 39th anniversary of the horrible tragedy, the murder of John Lennon back in December of 1980. Just outside his Dakota Building in the Upper West Side of New York City. And you went right to work and you found some amazing clips from the killer, Mark David Chapman. Just set this up for us.
Yes, I did indeed. I went back through my files and I actually got a few clips on Mark David Chapman and John Lennon. Some of the John Lennon ones are quite stunning, but we'll start off with Mark David Chapman. Of course, I remember the day very well when John Lennon was shot, same as I remember when Elvis Presley died, two of my great fans. So, okay, so let's have a look at Mark David Chapman. And this is an interview he did on Larry King. Now, I'm not too sure which one. He was actually on Larry King twice. So here's the first one here.
It was a rough thing.
What, had you shot that weapon before?
That weapon, no. I didn't even know if the bullets were going to work.
And here he says, "Go with my wuss," as in W-S-S.
Girl with no wuss.
Girl with no wuss. Girl with no wuss.
Go with my wuss. What does that mean?
Yeah. Oh, cowardly act. A wuss is a coward.
Ah, right. Yes. Like, yes.
Yeah. No,
well, he certainly was.
Yeah. It was a cowardly act. And then he says this one.
Were you relieved?
No. What happened was I was in a... What happened before the shooting, before I pulled the trigger and after, were two different scenes in my mind.
And he says, "I guess they're more powerful."
I guess they're more powerful.
I guess they're more powerful. I guess they're more powerful.
So it was a cowardly act, and he looked up at John Lennon as being more powerful, as being this this powerful figure. In point of fact, he actually gives him an interesting metaphor, and here is the metaphor he puts up for John Lennon.
Lennon in Ono's white limousine drove north along Central Park West, turned left at 72nd Street, and stopped in front of the Dakota's entrance at 10:50. Chapman was still waiting.
I see a limo pull up to the stoplight. And I know that it's him. I have this incredible feeling.
And he has a really interesting metaphor, our fanciful Mona Lisa.
Yeah, watch this boat, Mona Lisa.
And there it is.
That is very clear.
Very clear. And so he called him powerful. And so he obviously and compared him to Mona Lisa. He obviously had that. He in his mind, he was this figure of great power and value, you know. And I mean, that one I found in my files. It's been floating around in my computer for years, you know.
Right, so, right. That's why do some people in the reversals speak in metaphor? And some are just quite literal.
Right. It depends on what part of the mind it's coming from. When they're very literal, straightforward English reversals, they're generally conscious thoughts. When you're getting down to metaphor, you're getting down to unconscious thoughts and unconscious motivations. So that Pat fanciful Mose and Lisa shows that he was deep down into his unconscious. I mean, this was a very deep thing for him.
Now, some people have suggested, and I think there is some evidence to suggest, that he was a mind-controlled patsy. In fact, a British author, Brenton Fesler, who wrote a book about the murder, and Fesler interviewed one of the homicide detectives on the case. And the homicide detective agreed with him that Chapman had all the appearances of someone who was under some kind of mind control. If someone was under mind control, I'm wondering, I know on Reverse Speech Radio, you have done reversals on MK Ultra victims. I'm just wondering, you know, if someone were under mind control, would their reversals indicate guilt, or what would happen?
You would see it in their reversals. I wasn't looking for it, but there's one here that may actually indicate it. Let me just play this one. I'm skipping over two or three here. I think you brought that up. I don't know. Let's just play it.
Because without that, I probably wouldn't be alive today, because I was very suicidal. And I certainly wouldn't be in a well state of mind, not without him.
Did you have, prior to the conversion to the Lord, remorse?
It says, their soul in it enable.
Their soul in it enable.
Their soul in it enable. Their soul in it enable.
So what? Whose soul in it enable? What does that mean?
Their soul. Did he say their soul in it?
Exactly correct. Their soul in it. And I never had no idea what that meant until you brought that up. But, interesting.
Right. Their soul in it enabled. Interesting.
Interesting. All right. Let's look at a couple more on Mark David Chapman. Then
yes.
Get to Lennon, because I got a couple of real clangers on Lennon. All right. So here we have him again.
I pray, and I walk with him. He forgives me. He doesn't condone what I did, and that's a very important thing. He didn't like what I did 12 years ago. He didn't like all the pain I caused everybody, and especially John's widow. But he forgives me, and he hears me, and he listens to me, and he is the one, all these years, that has brought me out of the abyss, not medications or counseling. I basically had to counsel myself.
Okay, so he's talking about obviously a conversion, Christian conversion, but he says backwards, say, be lying.
Say, be that I am.
Say be lying. Is he saying that he's lying?
Yeah, he's saying that he's lying. It's a joke. He's just end point of fact, and then the very next reversal, he says this.
Well, in a way, it's got to be a crutch, because we all need a crutch. Life is not easy, and life for me isn't easy. And therefore, I think the Lord has a tender spot in his heart for prisoners. He said so.
He says the farce in it.
The farce in it.
The farce in it.
So his Christian conversion is a farce, and he's lying.
Oh, dear. Yeah, he's trying to convince the parole board, I guess, that he's redeemed himself. I mean, he does. I must say, he sounds sincere, but you know, that's what's that old line about? What does he have that I don't? Sincerity. Oh, I can fake that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, he might sound sincere, but the reversals are really quite opposite of sincerity. So, All right. I'm going to go straight to the two clangers on John Lennon. Okay. And then we'll play some more on Lennon. But these two are just amazing. This is on Lennon's last interview, 12 hours before he was shot. So, here we go.
He'll start coming down with stuff, you know, so I'm sort of obligated to keep up. But sometimes I can't, because something will make me depressed.
Okay, and here he says, Mark had madness.
Mark had madness.
Oh, holy smokes.
What's he saying, Mark? Now listen to this next one. Listen to this one. Here we go.
But I started the work, you know, and he started seeing a bit less of me. I'd let him come to the studio, but it was a bit boring. He was excited, but long story short.
This one says, Mark, he'll die in the cell. Now, the word Mark's very quick. I almost didn't include it, but my reversal checker, Jeff, my right-hand man, he agreed it was there too. So it's very quick, Mark, but he'll die in the cell. Certainly he'll die in the cell, clearly.
It would appear. He's been turned down how many times now for parole?
Ten times, yeah. So that's what we call a premonition.
I'll say.
That's they're very rare. We don't find them very often. And so here is Lennon 12 hours prior to his death predicting the name of his killer, and that's pretty amazing.
You must have fallen out of your chair when you heard that.
Oh, I absolutely did. That was just incredible stuff. I mean, that's just stunning. And they're so clear. Well, the mark isn't too clear of the second one, but certainly he'll die in the cell is clear. And,
yes. The only other time I've heard a premonition in a reversal since I've known you. And I've heard probably over the years with you, maybe close to 100 different reversals. That's a rough figure. It was the JFK during his inaugural address, I believe, when a reversal seemed to predict his fatal head wound.
Yeah. It was actually the reversal was head is hit in the car. And so this is from his inaugural address.
The slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
And this is head is hit in the car.
Head is hit in the car.
So, I've also got one.
That's chilling, David. That's just chilling.
Yeah, it is chilling. I've also got one on Princess Di predicting her death in a car accident. I'd have to hunt to find that. I can't play it now. I'd have to hunt to find that one. But these reversals on Lennon predicting his own death. I mean, not predicting his own death, but naming the name of his killer are actually really quite stunning. And then here's an earlier one on Lennon that I found in my archives. I have no idea when this interview is from, but let's just play it.
They concentrate the ammunition there. We know where it comes from, and we get on with the job of selling and or doing whatever we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that. You leave the door open, man, and that's where the door they'll come in, you know.
And he says, I feel the gunner. So that was just in my file.
I feel the gunner.
Yeah.
Wow. What is that? Yes. What does that mean, that the subconscious mind can do this?
Yeah, no, I was actually pondering that very question this morning. Look, first of all, let me say that these type of reversals are rare. They don't happen very often. But what they indicate is that we are tapped into a common collective unconscious that exists outside of time and has knowledge of past and future events. It talks to the incredible power of the unconscious, which we've only just begun to tap, you know. Look, I found one on a client just 2 months ago. Reversal was something like, I will be sad. And then about a month after that reversal, this man's partner died. And then, of course, he went straight back to that reversal and said, David, you know, I know what that reversal meant now.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, boy.
So they are happening. And I've just really only just begun to document them, really, just to start to really noticing them. But, quite amazing stuff.
Do you have another John Lennon or another Chapman?
Yes, I do. Here's another one, too, about dead.
Dear Mr. Lennon, from information I received while using a Ouija board, I believe that there will be an attempt to assassinate you. The spirit that gave me this information was Brian Epstein. He said the attempt would be made in place of March 6th, 17th. Mr. Epstein also said that Paul McCartney was alive in London.
Okay, he's talking about someone told him on a Ouija board there'd be an attempt on his life, and he says, get strong with dead man.
Get strong with dead man.
Get strong with dead man.
No, that's pretty clear.
That is pretty clear. It's also chilling. Gee, that one gives me chills. Mm. Yeah, so we're tapping into the enormous power of the unconscious. Oh, here's a cute one. Here he's talking about looking after Sean.
In Bermuda to the Botanical Gardens for lunch to the Italian restaurant because I could get espresso and Sean could get some junk food. And I was just walking in, I looked down and it was a botanical garden and it said, we're in the office, folks, that's why it's buzzing.
And then he says, then I pull on Nanny.
Then I pull on Nanny.
Then I pull on Nanny. Then I pull on Nanny.
He's being the nanny looking after his son Sean. Then I,
right, you know, right. That's what he was for 5 years in the Dakota, baking bread and being the house husband.
That's exactly what he was doing. Yeah, great loss, great tragedy, incredible musician, incredible human being, and Mark, John, David, Mark, whatever his name is, Mark, David, should die in the cell. Quite frankly, I hope Lennon's reversal comes true. Mark, you'll die in the cell.
Well, he's not getting out anytime soon, which is curious. I mean, you know, other killers have served less time and have gotten out. And I wonder, not that I'm suggesting he should be released, but I'm wondering whether someone is keeping him in there because he knows something.
Well, you could say the same thing about Sirhan Sirhan. I mean, he's been in jail since 1967 for the death of RFK.
Over 50 years. Over 50 years.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Okay, let me see if I've got anything else in the last few seconds we've got time for. Here's a nice one on Mark David Chapman.
As he progressively got worse, and I believe I was schizophrenic at the time, no one can tell me I wasn't, although I was responsible.
That- That's interesting. He's saying he's schizophrenic, but backwards, the soul, I like it. So he actually likes who he is.
Right. That was very clear. The soul, I like it.
Yeah. Interesting.
I don't know if you've heard this story, but Chapman supposedly told police when he was taken. I believe originally he was taken to Bellevue for an evaluation, a psychological evaluation, and he talked about a demon or two demons that told him to do it, and I believe he later described in an interview undergoing what he called a spontaneous exorcism while he was in his prison cell, and he felt these demons coming out of his mouth.
I don't know what I would say to that. Okay.
Pretty remarkable. We should tell people about Reverse Speech Radio, David.
Yes, we can. Yes, a new episode comes out every week. Our fan base is growing. We're getting more and more emails about it. So it's a totally unique show. There's no show like it on the face of the planet. And we explore reverse speech. And there's a link to it on my website, reversespeech.com. And you probably know their actual address better than I do.
Yes, people can. It's on the Libsyn platform, so people can go to reversespeechradio.libsyn.com. reversespeechradio.libsyn, which is spelled LIBSYN. So that's reversespeechradio.libsyn. radio.libsyn.com. New episodes every Thursday, just about every Thursday. I guess now that you're back in Australia and getting settled again, you'll resume producing new episodes.
Absolutely will. Yep. We're already got some next shows already booked in to record. So
and,
there we go.
Oh, and the last episode you did was Prince Andrew. People will want to check that out.
Yes. If you haven't listened to the Prince Andrew episode, you have to go and listen to it. It's a bombshell episode. If Buckingham Palace ever listened to that one, although Prince Andrew is toast now anyway, I was going to say Prince Andrew will be toast, but he's been excommunicated basically from the royal family.
So. Right. And that was during his BBC interview. All right. Well, thanks so much, David, and we will talk next week.
Yes, we will indeed. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. When we come back, Don Jeffries, the author of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics.
Take a look around. What do you really see? This is where you can tell all about it. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio.
Coming up next week on the program, Thomas Horn, the author of The Wormwood Prophecy, NASA, Trump, and a Cosmic Cover-Up of End Times Proportions. Don Jeffries has been researching the JFK assassination since the mid-1970s, when he was a teenage volunteer for Mark Lane's Citizens Committee of Inquiry. His first work of nonfiction, Hidden History, with the foreword written by Roger Stone, caused quite a sensation. His latest is Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. Don Jeffries, welcome back to The Conspiracy Show. How are you, my friend?
Fine, Richard. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you. This is kind of an ongoing series. We've been working our way through the book, both on this program and on my podcast. Because yesterday, December 7th, was the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. I wondered if we could start with that. You do an entire section in the book dedicated to post-war and pre-war America, but let's talk about December 7th, 1941, and this idea that it was a backdoor to war policy. Look the other way, let it happen, make it happen in order to get America into the war. Give me your general thoughts before we sort of break it down.
Okay. Well, I was very much indebted to the research of John Tolan in this. And John Tolan is a great example to everyone out there to what can happen to a revered establishment historian, as he was. He was a court historian in good standing. He'd won the Pulitzer Prize. They don't give Pulitzer Prizes to historians like me, and they wouldn't have given it to John Tolan if they knew what he was going to write. Then he wrote the book Infamy, and I believe 1982, and thoroughly documented, more than I can go into into a book like this, where I covered it in some depth, but I just kind of gleaned the most interesting tidbits from his research and Robert Stennett's and others. But clearly, he demonstrated beyond any shadow of a doubt. We're talking about what FDR's associates said around him, Winston Churchill said. Clearly, FDR was desperate to get us into that war and would have done anything he possibly could. And at that time, the sentiment in America was running very much against being involved in another European war, because Americans still remembered all the lives needlessly lost in the Great War, as World War One was caused and called. And I've yet to hear anyone, any court historian anywhere, be able to explain why America or anyone was involved in World War One. They can't even attempt to come up with any kind of a logical explanation for that. It was a senseless slaughter of far too many in Europe, and as far as any Americans' lives lost were obviously pointless, and it would become triggering to the left, and they would start yelling Nazi, when in fact the America First Committee is run by people like John T. Flynn, who was a classical liberal in good standing, was full of people like Upton Sinclair and people on the left who were anti-war in those days, honest anti-war people, and they did not want to get involved in another European conflict in which America had no interest. So FDR knew he had quite a task ahead of him, so you had to come up with a false flag. And the sinking of Lusitania, which was a joke, and you know, we've already been through that, where clearly Germany didn't sink that, but they used that as a false flag. They needed something more dramatic, and they came up with it, with something like this, where the dirty, sneaky, rotten Japs, you know, and they used that, and it was very racist, some of the portrayals of the Japanese, and they utilized that to great effect. And American opinion changed overnight. It was probably the most successful false flag in history.
Well, was it a case, Don, of make it happen, or was it look the other way, let it happen, and be glad it happened?
Yeah, well, I think it was more like let it happen and be glad it happened. I mean, the Japanese obviously did have to attack, so it's not I don't want to exonerate them and say it was a little bit different, I guess, than some of the other false flags, because the attack actually did happen. It was done by the Japanese, as opposed to the sinking of Lusitania, which was not done by the Germans, or the sinking of the Maine in the War of 1898, the first real false flag in American history, was not done by the Spanish. And even going forward to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, the Gulf of Tonkin, which really didn't happen at all, and it was just kind of a fake incident. So this was a real incident, and you have dramatic footage and so forth, and it worked wonders. Americans were out planting their victory gardens and buying their bonds, you know, within hours of this. I mean, it's, you know, we America First Committee folded up. And what I think was really illuminating after that is, unlike World War One, where there was a great deal of protest, and we discussed in a previous show how that's where the term you can't yell fire in a crowded theater comes from, a Supreme Court decision which ruled that Woodrow Wilson did have the right to throw World War One protesters like Eugene Debs into prison. Because of that, I think Americans remembered, and the false flag of Pearl Harbor worked real well. And there wasn't a peep of protest. They didn't have to worry really about locking up people. Now, they did, of course, incarcerate the Japanese, and they also incarcerated Germans and Italians. Now, they never got reparations, and they're not mentioned by anybody, but they did. We had concentration camps ourselves. So there was a lot not to be proud of in the home front as well as abroad during World War II for the good guys. But clearly, however you look at it, Pearl Harbor was a incredibly, I think, the most successful false flag in history, because even though the evidence is very clear that FDR knew in advance and was looking desperately to try any excuse to get America into the European conflict, still, you have people, if you just raise the issue, they, the court historians go nuts. I mean, it's like, you know, trying to argue that we never went to the moon. I mean, it's at that level. They don't want to discuss it, and they look at you like you're crazy, and that's what happened to John Tolan. Once he wrote this book, he went from Pulitzer Prize-winning historian to not being invited anywhere in polite society. He was shunned. He was called a Nazi, which is by Barbara Tuchman, another Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. He was drummed out of the club, and he ended his days in a very sad way. He had to, the only people that would have him would be Holocaust deniers and so forth. He had to go to their conferences because that's the only way he could speak. There's the only people that would let him have a forum to speak.
And that's unfortunate that he would have to get mixed up with that bunch. What would have happened, though, if the United States hadn't entered the war? Because I'm going to make an argument. Allowing Pearl Harbor to take place was kind of what they call the noble lie. Yes. It had to be done. Lives, unfortunately, had to be sacrificed to get America into the war, because had America not entered the war, there would have been dire consequences for Europe, maybe the world.
Well, I've certainly heard that argument before, and I don't think we have any way of knowing, because I think probably the worst that would have happened was that you would have had a Europe that would be under Nazi-type rule rather than what happened with Europe. Eastern Europe was signed over to the Soviets at Yalta. So I think you would have had, and maybe would have had a different kind of Iron Curtain or something. I think it would have been similar. I don't think it would have been dramatically different. But I think that we need to look at all this, and that's why I look at, when I'm writing about history, I don't trust anything necessarily that I'm told, especially about foreign leaders. Now, Hitler is the biggest boogeyman of all time. They're used to creating boogeymen, and it goes back a long way. And certainly in modern times, we're certainly used to hearing about whether it's Saddam Hussein or Noriega or bin Laden or Assad in Syria now, or Putin, whoever. We're constantly, which H.L. Mencken called, treated to an endless series of hobgoblins. And it's designed to make Americans clamorous to be led to safety, as he called it. You know, the foreign monsters, what John Quincy Adams warned us against. He said, America doesn't go abroad in search of foreign monsters to destroy. We've completely forgotten that advice, obviously, because that's all we do. So when you look at a guy, certainly the way they describe Hitler and the way Hitler has been depicted, he's the ultimate boogeyman of all time, and he's got such staying power as cannot even be imagined. I mean, he's still popping up in movies here or there. I mean, I guess people are not claiming he's still alive now, but who knows? You know, he's been claimed to create you've had horror movies with Nazi zombies and
but a reputation entirely deserved. The problem I find is that Hitler deserves all of that and more, but we tend to gloss over Stalin, who killed 20 million. We gloss over Mao Zedong, who killed maybe, 100 million?
I happen to believe that Hitler was an international actor, and there's any question about it. And if you read Professor Anthony Sutton's book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, he also wrote Wall Street and the Rise of Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, where he demonstrated how these multinational corporations supported these guys, and Hitler had support all the way. And I think Hitler was set up to be the designated loser in this World War II conflict. And I believe, as I write in the book, I don't think for a second that he killed himself in the bunker. I think he went on to live, the evidence shows that he went to Argentina, as did some other Nazis, and he lived out to whenever he died, decades later.
I agree. I think, and the idea that the Nazis, the Third Reich, didn't surrender. The German army surrendered, but not the Third Reich. We'll take a quick time out, come back. More of my conversation with Don Jeffries as we discuss crimes and cover-ups in American politics, 1776 to 1963, right here on The Conspiracy Show.
You're listening to The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio.
Just one final note on sort of the World War II section of the book. You mentioned the suicide of Hitler. Didn't they? I think it was Jerome Corsi's book, Hunting Hitler. Other people have written about it, but I thought he really sort of nailed the case shut that they performed DNA analysis on the remains that have supposedly been housed in a vault somewhere in the former Soviet Union. And they concluded that those bones, those remains belonged to a female.
Yeah, that's what I've heard too. And again, I think you're trusting, in that case, you're trusting the dreaded KGB. I mean, that's where you're getting your information from for that. And that's the problem with any, and that's why, you know, I mean, I obviously am writing about international history in this book, but it's basically America's involvement in that. And that's why I prefer, I concentrate so much on domestic issues, because I think when you, we talk of these things that are happening in other countries, we're, again, we're getting it through the filter of our state-controlled media and our masters who lie to us about everything. That's what I'm saying. And unfortunately, when you discuss the World War II era, you wind up either with the court historians who have demonized Hitler to the point where he's this figure that cannot even be humanized. And on the other side, what happens is then you get the David Dukes and the people like that on the other side who end up worshiping him and thinking he was a great guy. So it's hard to even discuss anything that happened there rationally, because they were our all-time greatest enemies, and we won the war, and history is written by the victors. So we wrote the history. So who knows? And that's why in my book, I don't concentrate very much on anything that the Nazis did, because lots of other authors have done that. And I talk a lot about Allied war atrocities simply because those are easier to document of what America and Britain did during the war, the bombing of Dresden, where they killed like 38,000 toddlers or something so unbelievable like that, had no military value whatsoever. And that I think that, again, it's important to remember that these are the good guys. All the rapes I talk about, this is out there in the public record, that the good guys, the greatest generation, they went over and they were, they did quite a bit of raping in both Germany and Japan. Now, the Soviets apparently were even more prone to that. But the point is that, you know, these are the good guys, and war is, you know, as Benjamin Franklin said, there's never been such a thing as a good war or a bad peace. And that's why when I analyze these wars, I'm looking at it that way. I don't think any of these wars are good. And World War II, so much bad came out of World War II. We're told, of course, that, you know, we defeated the ultimate monster in the Nazis, and it instantly, we suddenly had our Uncle Joe Stalin and the Soviets, who are our ally against the Nazis. Suddenly, they became the new monster. And, you know, it's very reminiscent of what Orwell wrote about in 1984. If you remember what he would do, history would change. So that we had always, one day we were always at war with Eurasia, Oceania was, and the next day, no, they'd always been our friends. And that's, I was reminded of that, you know, when I first read 1984, of how similar that was to the end of World War II. How one day Uncle Joe Stalin and the Soviets were our buddies and they were our friends and they helped us defeat the dreaded Nazis. And the next day they were the worst monsters in the world. So I think that it's important to analyze what happened there. And of course we can talk about the Nuremberg trials some too. I'd like to, because I think that's...
Well, we have to, because that feeds into so many things that happened in the 1960s with the space race and MK Ultra and perhaps even the assassination of JFK. A lot of that thing, I think, leads back to Operation Paperclip, where some of these monsters, and they were monsters, escaped the hangman's noose at Nuremberg. Their records were basically sanitized, and they were exfiltrated into the United States into sort of two main groups. You had the intelligence group that helped to launch the CIA, Reinhard Galen, and then you had the rocket scientists,
Wernher von Braun, and that's what I tried to point out in the book, is how really you had someone like Rudolf Hess, who if anything, out of all the Nazis, to me, he would have looked like the most reasonable one. Because he flew this dramatic peace mission to try to have peace with the British. He was ostracized from Hitler and did that. And they ended up immediately imprisoning him. And then he was imprisoned in decades as the only prisoner in Spandau prison. But on the other hand, Wernher von Braun and Reinhard Galen, people like that, they came through. Not only were they not punished, but they were instantly welcomed into the most important positions in the government. Talking about the CIA and NASA. So it's very curious how Operation Paperclip made instant top-level officials of some of these Nazis, and others had to be killed and hung. And I think it was the antithesis of justice, because up until that time, I don't believe any nation had ever thought to legally try an alleged court of law the people they defeated in battle. These were show trials. They were, as I point out, you know, they were sometimes presided over by these Soviet judges who had terrible records in terms of human rights abuses. And at the time, lots of Americans spoke out, including classical liberals, spoke out about what a terrible precedent this was. And one of those guys was John F. Kennedy.
Hmm, I didn't know that. All right, Don, you never cease to amaze. We'll take a quick time out. More of the conspiracy show awaits. My name is Richard Serrett.
Different views make great conversation. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett on Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Don Jeffries stays with us, and he will stay with us into hour two as we continue to discuss his monumental work, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. We were talking about Operation Paperclip. And that also, I think, helped fuel a lot of the craziness in the Cold War, because a lot of those Nazis that found their way into the military-industrial complex, into the OSS, which became the CIA, I'm wondering if they, because they were such rabid anti-communists, whether they ginned up the threat posed by the Soviets, who, let's face it, were absolutely devastated after the Second World War. So how much of the Cold War mania and paranoia actually was created by the exfiltration of Nazis into the military-industrial complex?
Well, I don't know that the ex-Nazis created it, but I think I describe it pretty clearly in the book how I think the Cold War was largely a phony war. And I think examples like Joe McCarthy prove that, because in my opinion, what you had Harry Truman represented, you know, once Roosevelt died, Harry Truman became president, and he kind of presided over this new, really much as the Nuremberg trials rewrote our standards of justice and set horrible precedents there. When Harry Truman came up with this new kind of contained warfare, where we were going to confront communism, the Soviets indirectly, never directly, always indirectly in the field of battle. And that first was in Korea, which is artificially divided up between North Korea and South Korea. And we went into another incredibly pointless conflict. Again, anybody that died in Korea, I'm sorry if your loved ones died there, but it was for absolutely no reason at all, other than for the war masters that, you know, the Smedley Butler talked about. Opportunities for profit, where he said war is always about opportunities for profit. It's never about enemies.
Let me just push back on that. We see this horror show that is North Korea. Had it not been for that intervention, wouldn't the entire peninsula be the Hermit Kingdom writ large?
I don't know. It's hard to tell what would have happened if we hadn't. The same thing with Vietnam. I don't know if we had not divided, but I do know that. Again, I think these what Truman did when we first had this conflict, and they never called it the Korean conflict, they never even called it a war because it really wasn't. And you had this, you know, Douglas MacArthur over there, who was kind of that old warrior that, you know, was the last of a dying breed. When he actually attempted to fight the war the only way he knew how, which was to attempt to win, Truman called him back and fired him. And he was considered kind of a, you know, you can't let the military overrule the civilians. Well, again, because Truman was presiding over what would now become common. And now, ever since then, American foreign policy is dictated by these interventions in other lands where they have all these demarcation zones and these rules of conflict, which leave the troops really as sitting ducks. And there's no policy. They're really left out hanging to dry. It's awful. And we saw, obviously, it culminated in Vietnam. But ever since then, certainly in the Gulf War and even today in Afghanistan and Iraq, Nobody knows why those troops are there. They don't even know, I don't think. They're just occupying for no reason. They have rules to follow. It's crazy. But it started in Korea. And when MacArthur went against that, he was swatted down. And they got more. They got military people in there who would follow the rules, which were, you know, made no sense, no military sense anyhow. But at that point, the Cold War became clear. This was going to be a war of containment, and what would happen is that somebody like Truman epitomized that, and Eisenhower would also kind of do it, where they bought into this Cold War concept, where the domino theory and all the nonsense that we heard, you know, later on, even as children. They were still talking about this stuff, which is why we fought in Vietnam. The Vietnam falls, and next will be whatever. It's the domino theory. But in reality, then you had somebody like Joe McCarthy, who was, I think, kind of a naive senator, but basically had good intentions. And he was actually trying to root out communist influence in our government. And there were connections. The KGB files would later reveal, again, our mainstream media is never going to report it because McCarthy became, next to Hitler, probably the most demonized figure in American history.
That's an excellent point. I think McCarthy was naive in that he really didn't appreciate or couldn't understand how much, I mean, I know people joke about a red under every bed. I think there's a great deal of truth to that. They even, and there was a book that came out recently. I interviewed the author on Coast to Coast, how they had, the Soviets had tried to co-opt Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you had going back to the World War II, you had the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And I think these were so many celebrities from Hollywood involved. And I'm not calling any of them communists. I don't want to sound like the liberals today, which are really all supporters of McCarthyism today, because they're, you know, Russia, Russia, Russia to everything. And, you know, you're a Russian troll if you do. They don't seem to sense the irony how they're sounding exactly like the people they hated in the 1950s. But I think McCarthy, he didn't really get bad press until he started going after the army, Joseph Welch and all those people. That's when, because he was pointing out, I think he was starting to pull the curtain back a little bit. What's the man behind the curtain? Because he was demonstrating what a fraud this Cold War was, and that I don't believe that the officials were, you know, they were Soviet agents. It's if there was this incestuous relationship going on, because it was a phony thing, a phony war. So you had all these people that were that had these connections. I mean, the Cold War, the KGB files later would reveal, and it was only published in the small little newspaper, The Spotlight, which became the American Free Press that I write for now. They were the only ones that had the courage to publicize it. Gus Hall, who was the American Communist Party's president for decades, had been paid millions of dollars over the year by the Soviet Union. And, you know, these were, if you had made those charges back then, oh my God, you're they would call you. You're a Nazi or whatever they would say. So these relationships were there. And of course, McCarthy's, as I go into the book, McCarthy's death certainly played, and I believe he was murdered. I don't think there's any doubt about it. He went into Bethesda Naval Hospital with a bad knee. He was 49 years old. And he died like a few days later. And nobody seems to know why or how. And, you know, these kind of things, even then, the body count was starting to pile up. And a few years before that, James Forrestal, who I go over quite a bit in the book, too, was the first modern Secretary of Defense, what we used to call Secretary of War under Truman. He supposedly jumped out of a window at Bethesda Naval Hospital. Most people don't know that McCarthy was good friends with Forrestal. And Forrestal gave McCarthy one of the great lines, which I've quoted on several talk shows now, and everybody seems to like it. But he told McCarthy one time, he said, "Joe, you know, if there wasn't a big conspiracy, once in a while, they would make a mistake in our favor. You know, once in a while, the odds would be that the law of averages would be that this wouldn't always work the same way." And I think that's a great way to describe what's going on. And McCarthy felt that Forrestal had been murdered. In fact, he wrote a pamphlet, the murder of James Forrestal. So these things are, you know, this is the kind of history that most people don't know. When you hear the name McCarthy now, it's a McCarthyism. Most people don't know that McCarthy was very good friends with the Kennedys. He dated some of the Kennedy daughters, and he was the godchild of Robert F. Kennedy's oldest daughter. Now I've heard that the Kennedy family's trying to disown that, but For years, that was published in a lot of places that he was the godfather. So.
That's fascinating. Well, you know, part of the mythology, I think, is because the person who in many ways is credited with helping to bring him down was Edward R. Murrow. And, you know, he's a saint practically in many people's eyes. And so if Edwin R. Murrow is against Joe McCarthy, McCarthy must be really bad. We'll take another time out. Come back with Don Jeffries, Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
Live from Toronto, Canada, Earth, The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett on Zoomer Radio.
Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. A big howdy to each and every one of you listening in on our flagship station, Zoomer Radio, AM 740 and 96.7 FM here in Toronto. Hiya to those of you tuning us in on one of our affiliate stations across North America. And hey you, streaming us live on the Zoomer Radio app and those streaming us on my YouTube channel, Strange Planet. Incidentally, there is no live stream tonight. That will return next week. And I see you all in the YouTube live chat, however and wherever you're listening. I bid thee the warmest of welcomes, and I thank you for your fine company. Coming up later this hour, a conversation with my late friend and partner, R. Gary Patterson, regarding John Lennon and the number 9, which seemed to follow him around his entire life and even in death. Here's a short article from Beatles University. During his years of seclusion, John Lennon dove headlong into numerology. It was just what he needed. Numerology could quickly be applied to any situation to get a preliminary reading on the future. Simple, compelling, and poetic, the laws of numerology have the power to make even the staunchest skeptic want to believe in it. Like playing the lottery, it can be addictive. After learning about numerology, John and Yoko were unable to walk out of the house without finding mystical significance in every license plate, addresses, and street sign. They would not so much as dial a telephone number without first consulting their Bible, Chero's Book of Numbers, which could have been subtitled Numerology Made Easy. Now, let's get back to Don Jeffries, the author of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. Don, I want to talk about Smedley Butler. War is a racket. One little pamphlet written 70-some years ago that is still quoted to this day and has, I think, inspired people like Tulsi Gabbard and others. But tell us a little bit about who Smedley Butler was.
Yeah, well, he was obviously a general, so he attained the highest rank you could attain in the military. And like many really great anti-war voices, he saw war firsthand. And unlike a pacifist like me that would be sitting home on the couch and just kind of being having an aversion to it, but and he wrote War is a Racket should have been the common sense, like Thomas Paine's pamphlet. It should have been the modern version of that. It didn't get the publicity it should have. Now, a lot of people do like it, but they don't. For instance, they don't. I was the first one. Huey Long's great-granddaughter didn't even know this, but Smedley Butler was very closely connected to Huey Long, my hero. And in fact, she was shocked when I told her I found all this, researching it, that Huey Long wrote a book called My First Days in the White House. Which he had the audacity to do, of course, before even running for president. And then, of course, they assassinated him, so it was published posthumously. But he had a fictitious cabinet that he named, and his Secretary of War, because this was before they renamed it Secretary of Defense, was Smedley Butler, the greatest anti-war activist of all time. So you know what kind of administration Huey Long would have had with Smedley Butler there. And Smedley Butler called being named Secretary of War in Huey Long's fictitious cabinet, the greatest honor of his life. And when Huey Long was assassinated, he came out publicly and said, my whole interest in politics has died with Huey Long. And even his great-granddaughter didn't know that. So they were very closely connected. So even though it's curious, because a lot of people on the left revere Smedley Butler, but they don't revere Huey Long. And in fact, they were Smedley Butler was the kind of leftist that I am, as was Huey Long. For instance, the Bonus Army, which we haven't talked about, the Bonus Army from World War One, which was overrun by people like a young Patton and a young MacArthur, and a young, even younger Eisenhower, unfortunately. They were routed from their tents on the Capitol lawns. They were promised a bonus, and they didn't get it. The U.S. government betrayed them. And in many cases, they were very poor. They needed the bonus. But so a young Franklin Roosevelt opposed giving them the bonuses. That's the kind of Clinton Obama leftist that even existed then, whereas Huey Long and Smedley Butler were in the forefront of demanding that they be paid their bonus. So you can see the difference if you go and study history and see what kind of people were out there. Even then, you can draw parallels to the kind of figures you right. see today.
And Butler's cynicism was earned honestly. He served in what were called the Banana Wars in the Caribbean
yes.
and in the Philippines. So he came to realize, just as the title of the pamphlet suggests, war is a racket. Talk to me, though. He supposedly caught wind. Well, he was asked to participate in this this business plot against Franklin Roosevelt. Talk to me about right. that.
Yeah, and that's something that the left talk. And I find that entire thing curious. Because, and I don't doubt for a second that he was approached. Because Smedley Butler was an honest man, so I wouldn't disagree with anything he said. So I'm quite certain he was telling the truth. I just have a hard time believing, as I write in the book, that this well-known anti-fascist, honest liberal, who would approach him with the idea of overthrowing Franklin Roosevelt at the behest of, a far right-wing a corporate group. I mean, why would they think that Smedley Butler would agree to do that? So I find the whole scenario very strange, and I don't know if it was conjured up to make Roosevelt look better, and that he was kind of this enemy of the corporate world when he wasn't. He was anything but that, as Huey Long pointed out over and over again. So I've always found that story to be very curious, and again, not because I doubt anything on Smedley Butler's part, but I find just knowing what Roosevelt really was, which was a toady of Wall Street and a toady of the big banks and of corporate America, and he was kind of playing this role as this kind of a milquetoast figure that was trying to meekly reform things. And thank goodness the pressure of people like Huey Long, we ended up with the very few things that came through the New Deal that were good. And one of them was the legislation in 1938, which gave us the 40-hour work week and the concept of overtime and things like that that American workers didn't have before that. And it was because people like Huey Long were advocating a 20 or 30-hour work week and 3 months off, all much, much more extreme worker protections. But I have lots of quotes from Smedley Butler in the book, and I don't remember them all off the top of my head, but he talked quite a bit, as you mentioned, about how the money he made for big corporations and how these smaller countries, especially in Latin America, were exploited. And certainly they're still doing that today. So these are very and of course later they would become kind of intertwined with was it United Fruit and companies like that were CIA affiliates that would Fletcher Prouty would later. He's kind of in many ways he echoed decades later what Smedley Butler was talking about, what his experiences were as far as the way the military and the intelligence agencies, along with corporate America, exploited these smaller nations. And Smedley Butler was a if people had listened to him, and if the left had been more like Smedley Butler and less like FDR, we'd be a much better country today.
Right. Old Gimlet Eye, they called him. do you know where that came from, that strange nickname?
I don't know that. And in fact, Smedley Butler, he died at a relatively young age, and I tried to, much as for this book, I was able to contact some ancestors of other figures. I mean, obviously, there aren't going to be too many people left alive from the events I cover in this book, but I wanted to find out, what butlers were left, what they, and I, I got nowhere with it. I don't think he had children, and I couldn't find any ancestors anywhere, and it was kind of a dead end, and I really couldn't find out very much about his death. I think he was maybe 50, if something like that. It wasn't that old.
Right. One of his more famous quotes: "There are only two things worth fighting for. One is defense of the home, and the Bill of Rights."
Begs him. And most of what he wrote, I could just sit there and say, right on. And that's pretty much what I would say. Those are the only two things I think I would fight for. And America hasn't fought. If you take out the attack on Pearl Harbor, which, again, I don't think that was a legitimate sneak attack, so I don't look at it like that we were attacked legitimately anyhow. I think the only time America has fought a war of self-defense was the War of 1812, when we were invaded by the British. Other than that, all our wars have been wars of aggression, where we've gone and decided to intervene or join a conflict overseas. And I think that's unfortunate. And it's certainly not what the founders intended. And if Smedley Butler, boy, the founders would have loved Smedley Butler, because that's exactly what they would have said. You know, yeah, exactly. We fight war, of course. I mean, I'm not a pacifist. If somebody, you know, actually attacks America, well, then of course I'll be out there fighting too. But unfortunately, for the Bill of Rights thing, I think that's largely been lost a long time ago, because most of our citizens don't appear to even believe in the Bill of Rights anymore. So they don't even seem to understand them. And look at what the interview the other day with the CEO of YouTube, which is, you know, very disturbing, where she's, you know, just not only, I mean, just basically bragging about, yeah, we've eliminated 70% of the controversial content because a lot of our people are starting to be persuaded by it. It's like, okay.
Yes. It's pretty odious out there, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is.
But we're going to jump back and forth here a little bit, but there's an obvious connection I mentioned with Smedley Butler, and that is Democratic hopeful Tulsi Gabbard, who sounds like, when she's on the campaign trail, like she's almost like she's reading right from Smedley Butler's pamphlet, don't you think?
Yeah, well, she's been caught, I don't know if this was on purpose or what, reading with a copy of JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas, you know, which is obviously a pro-conspiracy book. So because she has, you know, certainly there's a lot about her that's attractive, beginning with, you know, she's attractive, you know, physically, very attractive candidate, well-spoken, and she's certainly sounding the right notes on foreign policy, and she's calling us out, calling us to task for all these senseless wars, and she wants to, you know, she's talking about the treatment of Assange and Snowden, and certainly that's exactly right. So she appeals to me, but she's a member of the CFR, and there's other kind of curious connections there. So, you know, it's hard after Donald Trump. I don't know if I could ever be sold on a candidate again. I'm skeptical of everything, and we'll see what happens. But certainly the establishment seems to hate her in the same way that they have had such vitriol for Trump. So that speaks well of her. But I find it hard to believe, though. I know lots of people online that seem to support her, at least in my sphere. She seems to be the favorite candidate. And yet they continue to claim she's so far down in these polls behind Buttigieg. And I don't know anybody that supports him. So I don't, you know, again, I'm very dubious about the polls. But I would say, yeah, if there is a candidate that was closest to Smedley Butler, I guess she would be, considering all the other candidates are pro-war.
Mm, yes. The CFR connection I wasn't aware of.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Interesting. All right. Because we were talking about Smedley Butler, I had to draw that connection to Tulsi Gabbard. But I want to pop back to post-war America. And I want to talk about something you address in the book, and that is the cancer explosion in the United States.
Right.
Is that really when it happened, just after the Second World War?
Well, I think it started, I guess, early on in the 20th century. But I published, I have in the book there, I think it was the right around 1900, the leading causes of death in America. And cancer and heart disease, which are now by far the leading causes of death in America, were, you know, way down on the list. And I also talk about how there was a study recently by a major university where they studied mummies going back to antiquity, hundreds and hundreds of mummies, and they could find virtually no evidence of cancer anywhere. So I think the evidence is pretty obvious that cancer was created in some way And I have a lot in there about the vaccines. And obviously that's important, relevant now, because there's so much talk about the links between vaccines and autism. Well, when vaccines first became introduced, I guess, in halfway through the 19th century, I have lots of quotes from doctors at the time and scientists who were talking about, hey, this is dangerous. And later, lots of quotes from doctors who talked about there was a direct correlation between the introduction of vaccines and the explosion of cancer. Certainly, there's something there. It's something in the that we maybe in the food, the preservatives or whatever. But
what about the birth of the nuclear age and all of these test blasts?
Well, yeah. Well, you had that John Wayne movie, I guess, in the 50s where every cast member pretty much got cancer within a short period of time. So, yeah, there's no question about it. And if you also in the book in the same section, I talk about all of the hideous experimentation that went on all throughout the 20th century through our universities, much of it sponsored with government tax dollars and through foundations, and later with the intelligence agencies, especially the CIA and the military, where they did these kinds of hideous Frankenstein-like experiments where they were, introducing really bad diseases into mental patients and prisoners, orphans, the most vulnerable people in our society. And it wasn't, of course, we've all heard of the Tuskegee Airmen.
Tuskegee syphilis experiment, yes, which ran for 30 some years or maybe 40, and would have probably continued had it not been exposed, that they were deliberately infecting men with syphilis. And then they just wanted to see how this horrible disease would ravage the body, and they pretended like they were treating these people, but they weren't. It was just placebos. They wanted to see what syphilis would do.
Yeah, and it was hardly an isolated. Most people would think it's an isolated incident. It's not. That was publicized, but I have in the book, I have a lots of timeline of all the stuff going on, of introducing syphilis and other diseases, and even spraying whole communities with deadly diseases. I mean, it's just bizarre stuff. And then you have, groups of scientists that have gotten a hold of the terrible Spanish flu or whatever it was in the World War I era that killed millions, and are playing around with that. I mean, it's like apparently they haven't watched enough horror movies or whatever. Nothing's good is going to come out of that. But if you look at that chapter and just see all the chicanery that our intelligence agency and military were up to. And I talk a lot about Dr. Gottlieb and Dr. Ewan Cameron, the experiments on, mind control and brainwashing.
Up here in Canada. Yeah. Allen Memorial Hospital.
Right. Exactly. These were hideous. So the Manchurian MK Ultra was, and obviously a huge project, and that was just a part of it. And people, I don't think enough Americans understand. And this is our tax dollars that were financing this. This was not, some kind of something we weren't. We financed it, and lots of people were hurt. Dr. Frank Olson, under these things with the LSD, was almost certainly killed because of that. And his sons are still trying to get some kind of justice for that. So there's lots of hidden history there, and again, all this kind of exploded in the post-war era during the alleged Cold War, and with the growth of the military-industrial complex, lots of projects were going on. And who knows, there may have been things that we still don't know about. I mean, you can go to things like the Philadelphia experiment, who I may write about in a future book, with some other kind of supernatural type things where people believe that teleportation and invisibility was achieved in the 1940s.
Right.
And whether that happened, I don't know, but there's a lot of people that claimed it did. And, these are the kind of things that we don't know, because there were so much money channeled into the military industrial complex, and there were so many projects that we still may not be aware completely of some of them.
Well, the Philadelphia experiment connects with Montauk and Camp Hero, where a lot of those, there are some very fantastic allegations about the Montauk chair and time travel and how it was connected to the Philadelphia experiment. But there's definitely something going on in the far east end of Long Island, because this was this air base, Camp Hero, that has been decommissioned for almost 40 years, and yet the security there remains very tight. And these allegations that below the radar tower at Camp Hero is this labyrinth of this underground facility where small children no one would miss them. They'd be swept off the streets. They were, experimented on. And I'm wondering, and they called them the Montauk Boys, subjected to torture and drugging and so forth. I'm wondering if a lot of that time travel stuff is provided as cover, because once people start to talk about time travel in relation to what was really going on, most people, they lose the room. Most people walk away. It's a great way to put people off the scent of what the horrors that were really going on there.
Oh, sure. I mean, that would be a perfect cover story or a smoke screen or whatever. Yeah, there's no question about it. And but, you know, we started this talking about the cancer explosion, but I think that anybody that looks at the explosion of cancer and the fact that, you know, how many trillions have been funneled into these. I find it odd, you know, and I'll mimic Abbie Hoffman here. One of his great quotes, during the 60s, he said, you know, why do they call it the Drug Enforcement Agency, man? And it's a good point, you know, because what do they do? They're enforcing drugs. I mean, that makes no sense. It should be maybe the Drug Prevention Agency or something. But why do they call it the American Cancer Society? As if they're celebrating cancer, and all the organizations are like that, where it should be the American, you know, anti-cancer or something like that. But the Benign Society, even. And I don't think, and I, in Hidden History, my book, and also in Survival of the Riches, my other book, I talked about the fraudulent nature of charities, and included in that would be the American Cancer Society and places like that, where very little of the money that is funneled into these organizations goes into actual research, because they have so much overhead. They're paying their CEO a lot of money, and they're taking donations and paying for advertising to get more donations, the crazy way they do things. But, certainly at this point, we should have made advances. And all you need to know about how successful they've been is that in the last couple years, for the first time in my lifetime, the life expectancy of Americans is actually falling. And that should never, ever happen.
No. And when did Nixon declare the war on cancer? 1973. So it's been 46, nearly five decades. And
like the war on drugs.
Right. We're losing badly. We'll take a time out, come back with more of my conversation with Don Jeffries.
Shaking the world and seeing what falls. This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Sarrett from Zoomer Radio.
We were talking about the Cancer Society and a lot of these charities. I want to go back because you talk about these tax-exempt foundations. The Fabulous 50s, we talked earlier about Senator Joe McCarthy and the Korean War, but there's also a section in that chapter about the Reese Committee, which was examining these tax-exempt foundations. I'm guessing things like the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundations. What did they discover?
Well, it's very lots of interesting things. I point out in the book, one of the things they discovered went back to World War I, where they discovered that the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace, that connotates in people's minds, wow, they're working for peace. You know, there's a whole series of myths and there are discussions on how to get America involved in a war. And then later, World War I was going on, they talked about how can we make this last longer? And people can find the exact quotes in the book. I mean, this is under the auspices of the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace. And the Reese Committee and Norman Dodd, who was their chief investigator, he gave lots of interviews. I quote from him extensively.
He wrote the final report, yeah.
Yeah, and he talked about how they ran into such opposition. And just the idea of again, mostly the so-called liberal establishment was so much, and that would happen today. Because I just imagine today if you investigated the Clinton Foundation or the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that's the one I'd really like to investigate. Because I'm sure, and there's so, we already know, for instance, Bono, the rock star, his one foundation channels barely 1% of donations to actual research.
1%
overhead.
Oh,
1%.
Dear Lord.
So it's aptly named One Foundation.
Hmm.
Well, I've been attacked on social media for people that like you too and everything. It's like, look, I got nothing. It's not even talking about the guy's music. This is a reality. It's been exposed. It's been published everywhere, and it hasn't shamed him. It hasn't stopped him from pontificating, you know, about these subjects when he's got a phony foundation that is apparently making him and his cronies, the people on his board of directors, even wealthier. But this is, I think if Huey Long was alive today, he would really be looking at these foundations because that's where the wealth is. There's untold amounts of wealth in the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation because these are unaudited things, as much like the Fed is unaudited. Nobody knows how much, and certainly the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation for International Peace. If we know back to World War I that an organization named for international peace was plotting within their minutes about how to get involved in war, imagine what they've been doing ever since. So I would love to find out how much, and that's what the Reese Committee was trying to do, and they received a tremendous amount of opposition from the establishment, as you can imagine. And they really, I put in the book the best excerpts from Norman Dodd's interviews about what they found, and they did find some juicy tidbits, but it stopped there. And certainly the foundations have grown, and now they become. These foundations are every 1%er, once they become a 1%er, they if they get enough money, they create a foundation because it's a tax-free shelter. They learn early on this is a way for us to avoid taxes. And we also get great publicity.
Right.
Because we'll claim we're doing some kind of charitable work. Bill Gates, I mean, this is a guy that wants to reduce the human population, and he's not really very picky about how he wants to do that.
Well, I have to be fair about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and much has been made of this idea of vaccinations, and I think his aim, and we can argue about the efficacy and safety of vaccines, but I think his aim is to by reducing infant mortality, that'll have the effect of in developing countries, because if infant mortality is high, you have higher birth rates because. Out of 12 children, only 3 might survive. And so that's, I think, the end game with the Gates Foundation. They want to reduce infant mortality. That will bring the population down. However, when we're talking about the Rockefeller Foundation, I just had Paul Williams on the program, the author of Killing the Planet and How a Financial Cartel Doomed Mankind. It's primarily about the Rockefellers and the Pilgrim Society. Talk to me about the pervasiveness of the Rockefellers and its influence on every aspect of American society.
Well, I think you have to really, John D. Rockefeller, the original, the old man, was really the father of crony capitalism, monopoly capitalism, because he was famous for his quote was "competition is a sin," which is a curious philosophy for a capitalist to have, because capitalism is supposedly built upon competition. But he kind of gave the game away with that quote, is that, these predatory capitalists, they don't believe in competition, and they crush the competition. And certainly I write in the book about how Rockefeller, there's a conspiracy theory that says the reason why there was an early version of the electric car that was that Henry Ford had that was quashed was because Rockefeller had bought up all this oil, and they wanted to kind of steer Americans towards that. And that once Americans started to drive, all these gas stations started popping up everywhere instead of charging stations because people were buying the gas cars. And by the time all of they basically got a monopoly on that, so they had a vested interest in seeing that the cars ran because they obviously Standard Oil. And of course, Huey Long, again, going back to Huey Long, the Rockefellers are maybe his biggest, at least public enemy. He fought because through their Standard Oil, he was fighting Standard Oil, and he was naming them by constantly pointing out the Rockefellers and Standard Oil. So the Rockefellers have been front and center for a long time. And obviously even in the last, I think Jay Rockefeller, I don't know if he's still in the Senate or not, if he ever retired, I'm not sure if he's still a Senator or not, but, Nelson Rockefeller obviously was vice president after being governor of New York, and David Rockefeller just died not that long ago, because he was 99. He was kind of the dean of the establishment. They're always front and center, and I'm not sure who the young Rockefellers are at this point, but they're one of America's ruling families. I believe the Kennedys, I think John F. Kennedy had a quote he told friends a long time ago. People think, he said, you know, people think we're rich, and he kind of compared the Kennedys to the Rockefellers, and it's not, you know, it's not even relevant. The Rockefellers are that much wealthier. And then, of course, you go beyond the Rockefellers into the Rothschilds, the shadowy figures who, you know, unimaginable wealth. We really can't even calculate that.
Right. And what about the Rockefeller Rockefellers' involvement in things like the Cancer Society? The people talk about, you know, how the Cancer Society is really the cancer industry, and
right,
that the Rockefellers
right.
own, according to Paul Williams' research, the Rockefellers, you know, all of the chemotherapy and radiation, that's all right. under the control of the Rockefellers. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, well, that's these people like the Rockefellers have huge, you know, have lots, big investments in the medical industrial complex. Absolutely. The pharmaceutical industry and treatments like chemo. And so, they have a vested interest. It's, I've always said, you know, I believe that, you know, cancer can be cured. I believe they know what caused it because they pretty much created it. And they've known for a long time, but it's too profitable. Let's face it. If they came out with a magic pill tomorrow to cure all cancer, you take this and you know you're cancer free. What would happen to the medical industrial complex? There would be no more oncologists. All that right there. All the pharmaceutical companies that create the chemotherapy products, all that would be gone. And really, the major chunk of the medical industrial complex is cancer and cancer related diseases. All that would be gone. So. It's almost like, you know, when you talk about free energy devices, how would the gas companies react to that? You can almost understand how they couldn't allow it because they've got trillions and trillions of dollars of profits every year through the oil companies. And if somebody came up with free energy, that would all be gone. We don't need your gas and oil anymore. So you can, I mean, I'm not sympathizing with them because I think they're, you know, greedy and evil to be doing it, but you can understand how that works where they're not going to allow this to happen because they're not, none of these people are in it for the betterment of mankind. They're in it for personal profit and they're in it, you know, for their own lives being, and lots of them, I personally believe that a lot of these one percenters have secret technology. Look at Henry Kissinger. He's 96 years old and he's obese. He's walking around and I've said many times, if you go around and scour the earth, I would like to see any other example of a 96-year-old obese human being. I don't think they exist.
Right, they're usually pretty frail at that point.
Yeah, I mean, well, they wouldn't make it anywhere near 96 years old if they were obese. And Kissinger's doing just fine. And so that's, you know, I mean, of course, I can't prove that, but I mean, it's an observation, and certainly seems strange to me. So it wouldn't surprise me if they had this kind of technology for themselves, but absolutely the Rockefellers and many other very powerful forces have a huge vested interest in this medical industrial complex, and that's why their only solution is just to keep telling you to give to the American Cancer Society, give to the American Red Cross, give to these, you know, these American Heart Association, whatever, all these huge charities, because whatever it is, I don't know if all the wealth is being siphoned off into their pockets, but clearly it isn't going to any kind of meaningful research because there aren't any significant improvements being made on these ailments.
All right, Don, stay put. Back with more of The Conspiracy Show in a moment. Don't go away.
Don't be afraid of the dark. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To talk to Richard, call 416-360-0740 or toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Before I get back to my conversation with Don Jeffries, a quick note to remind you about my free monthly newsletter, Inner Sanctum. To subscribe, all you need to do is register at my website, strangeplanet.ca. All I need is your first and last name and your email address. Now, unfortunately, you just missed the December issue, but if you register right now, you'll get the January issue. It'll be delivered right into your inbox. And of course, once you've registered, you'll also be entered into the monthly draw for great Strange Planet gear, t-shirts, mugs, hoodies, socks, iPhone cases, and more. So why not register right now? Again, go to strangeplanet.ca. And don't forget about my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And to listen and subscribe, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. And we are approaching approximately 300,000 unique downloads per month. This podcast is really starting to take off. Okay, back to Don Jeffries. I know this is not part of the book because it ends in 1963, but today is the 39th anniversary of the murder of John Lennon, and I'm just wondering whether you believe the same forces, maybe even in some cases the same individuals, who may have been behind JFK, RFK, MLK, Malcolm X, were also involved in the murder of John Lennon.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I don't believe the official narrative in John Lennon's death. I don't believe any official narratives, but certainly not that. And I'm almost finished a book on showbiz right now. It's kind of a different. I'll talk a lot about the John Lennon murder in that book. And suffice to say, you know, his son Sean Lennon is a noted believer in conspiracy. There, one of the main investigating policemen is quoted on the record as saying, "You want to say it's a conspiracy? Yeah." There are lots and lots of strange questions there, and certainly Lennon was a figure that we know the FBI had been bugging him and trailing him for a long time. They tried to extradite him out of the country. So there was certainly an organized effort on the part of the American government to try to silence him, to get him out of the country. So, yeah, I don't think it's any accident that at that time probably the loudest voice for peace in the music world was assassinated in that way.
I always found it curious, and many others have, I'm sure, about the doorman that night at the Dakota, Jose Perdomo, who was a man of many aliases, and it turns out was recruited by the CIA, I think in Miami back in the early 60s, and he helped to assemble Operation 40, which was the CIA hit team that some people think also had a role in JFK's assassination.
Yeah, you isn't it amazing how these curious individuals show up? Just to give you another example of something like that, in this book, I talk about how there was a guy named Zapata, I think it was Douglas Zapata, who was confessed to, a lot of people think General Patton was murdered, George Patton. He confessed to murdering him at the behest of these powerful forces. Zapata went on to become one of Senator John McCain's chief advisors, and was a member of the 9/11 commission. Now, if you can explain how does that happen? So we find these, you know, the doorman at the Dakota having, I mean, if you scratch the surface, it's amazing the kind of people you find that are involved or associated with these events. And it's what makes me a so-called conspiracy theorist, because there's no other way to look at these things, because there's so many connections and questions that you have to turn off all critical thinking faculties to just say that they're all coincidences. Yeah, sure, there's some are, but there's far too many. And that's one of them, the Dakota thing. And that's just one of the really the intriguing things around Lennon's murder. But yeah, I don't believe for a second that I have in my book on showbiz ever comes out, I have it detailed a lot more. And I don't believe in many official narratives, like I said. So, and typically, whether it's John Lennon or Natalie Wood, John Belushi, any of those, and I cover all of them, even Elvis Presley, things like that, in the book, where I think there's always more to the story. And especially if you actually look and research and see what the evidence is. Wait a minute, you know, they're lying. I don't know why they're lying sometimes, but they, most of the time they're not telling you the truth about the, you know, there's, especially in showbiz, you know, Randy Quaid, you know, is kind of, kind of considered a wacky guy. He talks about the star whackers. There's something to that. I believe there is.
I believe so as well. I'm not sure if he's still up here in Canada. He sought refuge up here. I'm not sure. Maybe he moved back. He thought it was safe to go back. I'm not sure. Don, how do people get a copy of Crimes and Cover-Ups?
Well, it's published by Skyhorse, and you can get their publisher. Go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. It's in lots of places. If you Google it, you can find it. Get the best deal you can out there. Get your local library to, you know, you don't have to buy it. Tell your library to add it to their collection. It's in lots of libraries, but if it isn't, ask them to do that.
Don, always a pleasure. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you, Richard.
When we come back, we'll commemorate the anniversary of John Lennon's murder, December 8th, 1980, and I'm going to play part of an interview I did with R. Gary Patterson, my dear friend who died back in May of 2017, and we'll be talking about some of the strange coincidences or synchronicities surrounding Lennon's life and death, many of them involving the number 9. That's coming up next when the Conspiracy Show returns. My name is Richard Serrett. Don't go away.
When you look at the sky, ever wonder if someone's looking back? This is The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio. To speak with Richard live, call 416-360-0740 or toll free at 1-866-740-4740.
Welcome back. I thought we'd sign off tonight with an interview I did with my good friend, the late R. Gary Patterson, talking about John Lennon and the number 9. This first aired back in December of 2015. Here's how it sounded. R. Gary Patterson, a rock and roll investigator and the author of Take a Walk on the Dark Side, Rock and Roll Myths, Legends, and Curses. And I wanted to start the discussion talking about some of the, I don't know, the coincidences and some of the strangeness surrounding Lennon's life and career and his death with that number 9, which seemed to follow Lennon around. I mean, he was born on the 9th of October. We have the number 9 recurring in many of his songs, Revolution 9. One After 909, Number 9 Dream. Where else can we find the number 9 with John Lennon?
Well, as you said, he was born on October the 9th. He was born in a city, Liverpool, with 9 letters. You can go through even the numbers on the license plate of the policeman who was off duty that hit Lennon's mother and killed her. The numbers added up to 9. He was aware of that. He was also, if you look at November 9th, 1961, that was when Brian Epstein discovered the Beatles.
At the Cavern
and
Club.
9 years later, they'll break up. That's right. 1970. Right. Also, he meets Yoko Ono on November 9th, 1966. So the 9 played a role there. Of course, they became, you know, major Beatlemania in the United States when they played the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964.
There you go.
When Lennon and Yoko arrived in the United States, they eventually stayed at the Dakota, but they came into the United States in 1971. You had 9 years to that. That's 1980. The year he died, his apartment at the Dakota was number 27. Of course, that makes 9. The Dakota is located on West 72nd Street, another 9.
Right.
And he was shot there, and that was on 72nd Street. He was rushed to Roosevelt Hospital that had 9 letters. Roosevelt Hospital is located on 9th Avenue, and he was pronounced officially dead at 11:07. So you had 7 + 1 + 1 = 9, and he was born at 6:30 p.m.
Oh.
So 6 + 3 = 9. So he was born on a 9, died on a 9. A lot of people say, well, you know, he died on December 8th. Wouldn't it have been weird if he had died on December 9th? But you got to remember, he was a British citizen. And at the moment of his death, when it was announced in England, it was already 5 hours ahead, so it was already December 9th at that time.
There you go.
Another thing is that his son Sean was born on his birthday, on October 9th.
Hmm.
So, you know, you can look at it. I think they were together 9 years, you know, Yoko and John. So there's so many things you could do a book on the number 9. I know that I have a lot of that listed in Take a Walk on the Dark Side, because to be aware of a number that would affect your life forever And, I mean, he knew that, of course, obviously, because he had, even in when he was in the very early days of the Beatles, you had the one after 909. And so, obviously, he was aware of it then. Of course, he was in a group called the Quarrymen. That was nine letters also. McCartney, right. When he meets Lennon, McCartney had nine letters in his name, the only Beatle with nine letters. And that became his prolific songwriting partner throughout, you know, Beatlemania. So, you know, you can look at that and you can say, oh, that's a coincidence. Isn't that a coincidence? But, you know, sometimes the definition of a coincidence, Richard, which we know, is an explanation waiting to happen.
There you go. I've got another one here for you, because we heard Whatever Gets You Through the Night, which was from Lennon's 1974 album Walls mm-hmm. and Bridges.
Right.
The album was his ninth non-Beatles right. album. It was issued in the ninth month of the year, and number nine Dream... let's see, on the Billboard Hot 100, where do you think it peaked?
I think it peaked at nine.
At number nine. My word. That's, I mean, and obviously Lennon was, oh, you mentioned Roosevelt Hospital. Ninth, did you mention it's on Ninth Avenue?
Yeah.
Oh. Now, I mean, was Lennon, I believe Yoko was heavily into numerology. Was Lennon into numerology?
Oh, he was into numerology, astrology. I know that Yoko used to control him at times for not going anywhere by telling him, John, Mercury's in retrograde. And so, you know, I think that she really sort of, he had an interest, but I think she really piqued that interest. And, you know, they would have a number of psychics over at their homes. They would do readings. When they moved into the Dakota, the actor who owned it had passed away. So they did a seance to contact his spirit to see if it would be all right for them to have the apartment, you know, that the spirit wouldn't bother him. I think it was Jack Ryan, something like that. I have to look it up. But when they did the seance and they spoke to the spirit, they notified his daughter that they had talked to her father in the afterlife, and he'd give them permission to have his old place at the Dakota. And I'm sure that his daughter enjoyed that. But anyway, I mean, they were into it. And, you know, when you take a look at the Dakota, in a Playboy interview, there's a scene where Lennon's doing his interview, and he hears gunshots.
That's right.
And he turns to the writer, and he says, oh, another murder at the Rue Dakota. Well, in its entire 99-year history.
Oh, dear.
In its 99-year history, there was only one murder at the Dakota, and that was John Lennon. And there's a gate on the other side. It was called the Undertaker Gates, that if someone who died at the Dakota, then their body would be taken out that way, like Boris Karloff. I remember he passed away as one of the tenants of the Rue Dakota. But it's kind of interesting, you know, when you take a look even at the Dakota, had its 99-year history with John Lennon being the first one murdered.
Right.
You know,
did that line actually make it into the Playboy interview?
Did what now? The line did, yes.
So foreshadowing.
Yeah, a little foreshadowing, you know, that he would say that. And, I mean, did he have a premonition, Richard? What do you think? Were there premonitions with John Lennon that he knew that he was going to have a short life?
Well, he actually predicted it, didn't he? Someone somewhere asked him, how do you think you're going to die, John? And he said, some loony's going to pop me off or something like that. Do you remember that interview? I can't remember where or when, but he said that.
You know,
some loony is going to pop me off.
Yeah. Fred Seaman.
Yes.
In his book, mentioned that Lennon was convinced that he would be shot to death, that it was a modern form of crucifixion.
Wow.
And that for his line, the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ, that he would see that. That would be some sort of, that would be the way it would go. Some loony with a gun would shoot him. And what was odd is that he was shot five times. And did you know that Mark David Chapman stops in Atlanta before he comes to New York to kill Lennon? He tells this policeman, who's a friend of his, that he doesn't have any bullets for his gun. He's going to New York. He needs it for protection. So the police officer gave him five bullets.
They were hollow point, too, weren't they?
Yes. Well, he meant business when he did this, but Lennon was shot five times, and if you know anything about medieval literature and you take a look at cross symbols, you take a look at the number five. And the number five, for instance, if a knight had a five-pointed star on his shield, like Galwin in the Green Knight,
right.
The five-pointed star stood for the five wounds of Christ.
Oh, my.
So you always take a look at the five bullets, and I think about the five wounds of Christ, you know, the crown of thorns, each hand that sleep together and a wound at the side. And you take a look at those five, and you're saying, you know, this is odd, you know, that you had the medieval concept of the Christ figure with the five wounds, and then John Lennon being shot five times and saying that would be the way he would go. And, you know, that was documented much earlier than that. So, yeah, you have a premonition. And the song, number 9, Dream, you know, isn't that kind of odd, too?
Yes, there's something very ethereal and haunting about that song. Every time I hear it, it gets me.
Yeah, me too. I have the same, it have the same effect on me. And the line where he says, someone calls out my name.
Ah, yes.
And you hear John.
John.
And May Pang told me that that was her voice. That she was the one who went in to the studio with John, and she's the one who calls his name softly. But after John died, Yoko had May's voice removed and placed her voice saying John.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And of course, someone calls my name, and we know Mark David Chapman called out to him, Mr. Lennon.
He did, Lennon.
Mr. Lennon.
So he turned his head. Someone did call out his name.
There's a little bit of my interview with the late R. Gary Patterson from December 2015. That's it for me. My thanks to Owen Wolf and Ryan White. I'll be back next week with Thomas Horn, author of The Wormwood Prophecy, for the full 2 hours. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light, and what I say in a whisper, proclaim from the rooftops. Move over, Aphrodite, I'm coming home. Good night.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.